Hey, welcome to Our Altered World. If you've been feeling overwhelmed by the giant that is climate change, you're not alone. I'm Neil, and here we celebrate the inspiring work of individuals and organizations making real positive strides that you may not have heard about. My hope is for our conversations here to make you feel inspired and reconnected to our planet. And with that said, I would love to introduce Gladys Galema Zikusoka from the Conservation Through Public Health.
Thank you so much, Neil. I'm excited to be on the show.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. I'd love for you to tell our listeners a bit about yourself. How did you first become interested in gorilla conservation? And what brought you to found Conservation Through Public Health?
I first got interested in gorilla conservation as a teenager. I grew up with a lot of pets at home, and my elder brother used to like bringing stray cats and dogs home. So by the age of 12, I felt like I wanted to become a veterinarian. And then I had an opportunity to set up a wildlife club at my high school in Uganda, Chibuli Secondary School. And we went to the national parks and Queen Elizabeth National Park, actually, which was named after the Queen of England in the 90s when it was created. We went over to the park and I was a little bit disappointed because there was very little wildlife. The elephants had moved to Democratic Republic of Congo because there had been a lot of poaching and civil war in Uganda under the President Idi Amin era. And there were no lions or leopards. So they actually let us do a walking safari because nothing could eat us, which was fun. But I kind of thought, why don't I become a vet to also can bring back Uganda's wildlife to its former glory, having been called the Pearl of Africa by Sir Winston Churchill several decades ago, partly because of the wildlife. And then while setting up the wildlife club, I also met a warden in the National Park offices who told us that there were mountain gorillas in Uganda. They had just discovered them. This was in 1987. And I was very excited. I wanted to see them. And he said, no, they're not habituated. They've just been discovered through going through the night nests and finding fecal samples, which were analyzed in California. And so I always had at the back of my mind that we have mountain gorillas. But, you know, it wasn't until I started doing my veterinary degree at the Royal Veterinary College, University of London, that I had an opportunity to go back to Uganda and do a study on the mountain gorillas at Bwindi, Penetrable National Park, when they had just been habituated and tourism had just begun. And it was an amazing place for me to be because tourism had just begun. So I saw how tourists were helping local communities because a lot of poachers were being hired as rangers and trackers. So we used to call them born-again poachers because they were earning a better living, protecting the wildlife rather than killing it. A lot of tourists used to want to hear what I have to say. And so I just saw how tourism is really helping conservation. Also, many of the few lodges that were there hired many people from the community. And so I began to see the positive impact of tourism on conservation. But also my study looked at fecal samples in the gorillas to see whether they were picking up what parasites they had. And I found that the two habituated groups for tourism had a higher parasite burden than the one visited by researchers. And there were just a few researchers visiting it and more tourists visiting the two habituated groups. So I attributed it to either stress or them picking up human parasites. But my study couldn't go ahead to prove that. But it made me realize the impact that the positive and the negative impact that tourism can have on the gorillas. So after that, I felt like I wanted to become a full-time wildlife vet. And that's when I became the first wildlife vet for Uganda because I'd never had a vet working with wildlife. And eventually that led us to setting up Conservation Through Public Health when people made gorillas sick.
Wow, what an incredible journey you have been on. And it sounds like it has also been incredibly rewarding from your experience of having that early childhood connection with animals and conservation through to your studies as a vet and now to founding CTPH. Now, the name Conservation Through Public Health, it suggests such a unique approach. How would you summarize your mission and your methods to someone who's new to your work?
Yes, we selected that name because we wanted an active name, you know?
Very active.
That shows exactly what you're doing. I did a certificate in non-profit management at Duke while setting this up. And while I was doing a zoo medicine residency in North Carolina, and we came up with it.
You want a standout name. You're like, this one is going to stand out. I would definitely say it does.
And the reason why I selected that name is because, you know, when people made gorillas sick, and it was the local communities who made the gorillas sick, actually, not the tourists, because they have less than adequate healthcare and public health, we felt that we really need it. You couldn't protect the gorillas without improving the health of their human neighbors. And so we wanted, the main reason we set it up was to make sure that we are improving the health of the people together with the gorillas. That's the main reason we set up CTPH. We're trying to prevent zoonotic disease, diseases jumping back and forth between the people and the animals. But at the same time, I realized that if you improve the health of communities, they'll care more about the wildlife because you're showing them that you don't only care about the wildlife, the animals and the forest, you know, the wild animals and the forest, you also care about them. And healthcare is a basic human right. So that was kind of also another underlying reason for setting up CTPH, to improve community attitudes to conservation. But the main reason was to directly prevent zoonotic disease transmission between people and wildlife.
You're really looking at the precipice of the interconnectivity of humanity and nature, and especially in regions like Uganda, where there is a lot of potential for the transfer of zoonotic diseases. On that note, I know that you had a lot of work with the early scabies outbreaks in Bwindi's gorillas. How has your strategy evolved since the establishment and discovery of that since 2003?
I'll say that the scabies outbreak was one of the eye-openers, because we always suspected that people make gorillas sick. And that's why I convinced Dr. Edroma, the head of the national parks, to hire me sooner than they were going to do it, because gorilla tourism had just begun and I'd spent a whole month, my whole summer, part of my summer
you,
there.
You saw it. You were like, this is going to blow up and we need to get ahead of this.
We needed to get ahead of this. So having done that, then when we got one of the first diseases that was reported to me was the scabies. They said to me gorillas were losing hair and developing white scaly skin. So I asked a human doctor friend of mine that what is the most common skin disease in people in Uganda. She had also done her training in the UK. And so she was able to explain to me that, yes, it's not common in the UK, but it's common in Uganda because low-income groups of people have common diseases like scabies, tuberculosis, which are preventable. So I put it all into context. And so when I went to Bwindi, I went with a drug that treats scabies, which is ivermectin, the famous ivermectin that became famous during COVID. It doesn't treat the viruses though like COVID, but it treats parasites like scabies. So when we got to Bwindi, thankfully it was scabies and not ringworm. I led the team. We treated the gorillas. They got better, but we lost a baby gorilla. And when we did the post-mortem of the baby gorilla, the mites were still crawling. You know, the scabies mites were still alive when the baby had died. And so we looked around and we saw that these two habituated gorilla groups were always going outside the park. The reason why is because now they'd lost their fear of people and they were going to range in places they used to range before their forest habitat was cut. And so that is why they were now finding people who have less than adequate hygiene. You know, they put dirty clothing on scarecrows to chase away baboons, gorillas and other wildlife. And the big gorillas are very curious, especially the young ones. They probably touch the clothing and it spread through the group. And so we realized then that you really needed to improve the public health of the people. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to help the gorillas. And so that's kind of how this whole approach developed, scape conservation through public health.
I love that. It's really not about just looking at something through one lens. It's saying, okay, these are two factors which are compounding each other, but in a way that will benefit both the community and the surrounding wildlife. You mentioned just there briefly the habitat loss that was occurring in the forestry regarding the mountain gorillas. Beyond habitat loss, how is climate change affecting mountain gorilla habitat and Uganda's forest? And what steps are CTPH taking to address these environmental impacts?
Yes, beyond habitat loss, where it's a very hard edge between the community and the park, climate change, we feel, is beginning to affect the gorillas and the forest habitat. Actually, when decision was made to protect the gorillas and start tourism, having been discussed, covered, habitat loss reduced, and that helped with climate, because that by protecting a charismatic species like the mountain gorilla, you help to keep the forest intact. Otherwise, the forest was being cut at a very fast rate. I mean, it was part of the forest reserves because they were supposed to cut them sustainably for firewood, but it wasn't sustainable. And so now just creating the national park helped to stabilize the climate in the area. But however, now progressively, it's now been 30 years since gorilla tourism began. And we are also seeing the impacts of climate change in a place like that, that has a fairly thick forest. It was called Bwindi Impenetrable Forest because it was difficult to get through. And Bwindi means place of darkness. The local community called it Place of Darkness because it was dark inside because it's a thick forest.
Very dense.
Very dense, thick forest. Mm. But we are seeing, you know, extreme weather conditions. Right now, you know, I was just there last week. It rained so heavily, like so heavily.
Unexpected for this time of year.
Yes, we do expect rain, but not that heavy. So very heavy rain or long periods of drought. This rain affects the community. I'll start off by talking about the community. When we've had heavy rains, it's washed away their crops. And it's part of the reason why we support them with fast-growing seedlings so they don't get hungry and go into the forest to poach. So that affects conservation directly. But something else that, oh, if it's very dry and their crops are not growing. But another problem we have is that there's been an increase in temperature over time. When I first started working with the mountain gorillas in 1996, the first full-time wildlife vet for Uganda, there never used to be malaria. You never even used to have mosquito nets in the houses, you know, in the cottages or the lodges. But now you do because the climate has warmed. And when people get malaria, they get it really badly because they don't have immunity to it, unlike other parts of Uganda. And so we're worried that as malaria incidence is going up, maybe other zoonotic diseases that can easily cross over to wildlife back and forth can also increase. So that's something that we're trying to track. But also we're concerned that because of the rising climate, so the water sources in the forest maybe are drying up faster. Gorillas tend to get moisture from the food, but some of these foods may be reducing. If they do find water in the forest, they'll drink. In fact, you find that Bwindi gorillas drink more than the Virunga just because there isn't water sources in the Virunga like there is in Bwindi, you know, in the forest. And so sometimes we feel they're going outside the forest maybe to look for foods rich in moisture or water. And maybe that's also resulting in increased human-wildlife conflict. Because we know they go outside the forest to eat banana plants. They like the stem more. But we don't know if they're also looking for other things when they go outside the forest. But all of that is being studied. So in other words, we're trying to study the impacts of climate change on the gorillas themselves, but we're also seeing it on the community. But we see that our One Health approach to conservation is helping to mitigate the impact because we're making communities better have better health and well-being. We have interventions like family planning where they have manageable family sizes so that they're not forced to enter the forest to look for food because they're having less food at home because of climate change. So in fact, I was excited to be I was on the BBC 100 list in 2023 and among the 28 climate pioneers for our One Health approach to conservation, which made me realize that actually, yes, what we're doing is probably having an impact, helping with climate action.
100%. I can definitely see that. And how incredible for you. I mean, what an achievement. I'm super excited to jump into the rest of your work. We're going to go on our first commercial break to hear from our station sponsors, and we'll be back soon.
The station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Gladys Kalema Zikosoka from Conservation Through Public Health. We just left off on her talking about the intersectionality between wildlife health and the public health of the local Ugandans that are at this intersection of both zoonotic diseases and the effects of climate change that are impacting both of these communities. Now, Gladys, you've spoken about some incredible work that you guys have been doing within the local areas. I'd love to dive into how you guys are using innovative village health and conservation teams. Can you explain how these reduce the human gorilla disease transmissions, and maybe in a bit more detail, as well as the pioneering One Health approach you spoke about and how that interacts into wildlife conservation?
Yes, thank you. I'm glad to be back on the show. I'd say that the village health and conservation teams is a model that we came up with. It developed over time because we realized that many people are not able to go to their local health centers. They're like 20 miles away and there's hardly any public transport. And so people have to be carried on stretchers if they're really, really sick. They have stretcher societies. And by the time they get there, it's too late. So there was a need to bring health services closer. And one way was through the village health and conservation teams. So at the first time we first recruited both people from the local community, we spoke to the local leaders, and they got people who could read and write in the local language and who are trusted. Because if they're trusted, then people can model their behavior and believe them. And they have to be from the community. And so we taught them to do both health and conservation work together. But later on, when the government village health team system came around to Bwindi, all village health teams became village health and conservation teams. So they're essentially community health workers doing conservation work as well. And so it's grown over time. The first thing was, of course, to prevent zoonotic disease, to look out for people who have tuberculosis or scabies and or HIV suspects and refer them to the health centers. But then later on, we added hygiene and sanitation, and where we try and make sure that they're able to have hand washing stations outside the toilet and, you know, cover the rubbish heap and things like that to prevent contamination of the environment and open defecation and things like that. Then after that, we added family planning, community-based family planning. And this came around also because of another donor. And through that, after Woodley Fund for Nature funded the hygiene, then USAID came and supported us with setting up family planning, adding on to the infectious disease model we already had. And we found out that people had too many children who they didn't want to have. They're having like 10 children per woman in a family, and she didn't really want to have all these kids. She wanted to do something else with her life. And so they were really embraced the family planning program. So did their husbands, because we presented it as balancing the family budget to reduce poverty in your home. And so that really enriched our programs. Then after that, we added, and actually our family planning rate was lower than the country average. Within 10 years, it was higher than the country average for rural areas, because the women were desperate to stop having babies every year. They wanted to have more control over their bodies. Then later on, we also realized that we could use this method, which is reaching everybody, you know, because a lot of conservation groups would try and reach everyone, but they'll do it by having a meeting in the village. And whoever makes it to the meeting, hears what's being said. But there are other people who don't make it to the meeting, don't. And they're the poorest of the poor, bordering the edge of the park. They live further away from the trading center. And they're the ones the most
people
likely
who
to poach.
Yes. Need to hear it the most.
Exactly. So what we did is we used that public health model to carry out conservation work. So a lot of conservation education. They've always talked about the risk of preventing disease the risk of getting zoonotic disease or getting it from eating other animals in the forest, like bush pigs or dikers. But people in Bwindi don't eat gorillas because it was considered bad luck to look in the eyes of a gorilla. But if the gorillas cross to neighboring DRC, they get eaten because people think that if you eat a gorilla, you can become as strong as a gorilla. So we talk about, they do. So we talk about that whole, the dangers of eating bushmeat, but also how they could make people sick by, you know, if they're unhealthy and unhygienic. And a lot of them are benefiting from tourism, so they don't want to make the gorillas sick. They need to have healthy gorillas. And so another area that we added on, we kept adding things on this model because they're reaching everybody's home.
As you learn, you keep adding new elements onto it, for sure.
Exactly. So one of them was sustainable agriculture, because it's a place which is very steep, very, very steep. And people were already terracing. And now we made them, you know, through agronomists, we made them plant better using proper soil and water agriculture conservation methods, which really helped. And then we also found that, you know, that some of the tourism revenue is shared with the local communities in Uganda, and 20% of the park entry fee and $10 from every permit, gorilla permit. But we found that not everybody knew about it and not everybody was accessing it. So it wasn't having the direct benefit it wanted to have. So these same volunteers talk to the community how they can write proposals to access funding from ecotourism.
Wow.
So we basically get them to do so many things.
This holistic overview that you came into conservation and health with has had so much expansive impact. And I love the way that you're displaying the way that it's grown year on year by having that sort of public learning as well, understanding the community needs, getting out there, being like, okay, we've realized this, we need to bring in these teams. It's so fantastic to hear that a organization like that can grow and learn from these understandings that this information is bringing in. I think with the way that you guys have grown, what have these interdisciplinary approaches revealed about the human and gorilla interactions that you may not have thought or considered going into it. So, for example, you mentioned the eating of the gorillas. That was new information to me. Like, I didn't know that there was differences in the way that communities approached and viewed hunting and feeding on gorillas. So I'd love for you to dive into a bit of the information around that.
Yes, it's been a huge learning experience. For example, when we started out, we used to have community drama groups, and they always had this scene of the child gets sick and they go into the forest to hunt for bushmeat because they believe that bushmeat is the only thing that will make their child better.
Okay.
And of course, we're trying to tell them, actually, it's going to make their child sicker, you know, because they're likely to pick up viruses or things like that they didn't even know about, or parasites, or, you know. So it's that I found was already a cultural belief that bushmeat can make your child get better. And that's obviously something that affects conservation and public health. Also, there's another thing that came up when we started to engage traditional healers is that they said that they want to get medicine, but since it became a national park, they don't have free access to go in and access medicine in the park, you know, medicinal plants. And so we had a meeting together with the community conservation ranger from the Wildlife Authority and the district health people from the Ministry of Health. And we all said that, why don't you get, there are certain areas where they're allowed to go in. So go in, pick up the medicine, you know, the plants, and plant them in your garden. I actually write about this in my book, Working with Gorillas, how they argued that the medicine wasn't as much if it's not in the forest. So that was a very interesting experience for me, engaging traditional healers in our approach. But one thing I can say that I really enjoyed, which was an unexpected outcome of our work, is that we started to engage women in conservation, because conservation has been predominantly a male-dominated field, conservation and natural resource management, and public health has been predominantly a female-dominated field. The nurses are women, the health workers are women, but through our approach that's integrating conservation and public health, we found that we're engaging women more in conservation and men more in public health, which is really important to have gender equity on both sides, because both men and women affect conservation and public health outcomes.
Incredible. When you've inspired so many active changes within the communities and the way that they approach work, for our listeners, for example, what actionable steps can they take to support gorilla conservation through CTPH or expansively with your organization?
Well, there are a number of steps they can take. One of them is to get to know more about what we're doing. They can follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms, Facebook, Twitter, or X, Instagram, more recently TikTok, LinkedIn, of course. I'm on LinkedIn, and so is my organization. We're all on all the platforms. They can sign up for our e-newsletter. They can visit our website. They can buy my book, Working with Gorillas, to learn more about what we do. They can also donate and volunteer with us. We accept volunteers from all around the world who have expertise in different areas or are interested in the different things we're doing. You know, the veterinary work, the public health work, the conservation education, and also that we work with schools as well. So not just adults, but also the school children. And we also have an alternative livelihood program, Gorilla Conservation Coffee. And Gorilla Conservation Coffee is a social enterprise that we set up to support the farmers. We found out that people were still poaching because they didn't have a good price for their coffee, and they're still entering the forest to poach. So by buying coffee, it's available in the UK, US, New Zealand, and many other places. You can support our work. And so that's
fantastic.
One way of doing
and what,
it.
What is that coffee called again?
Gorilla Conservation Coffee.
Gorilla Conservation Coffee. I love how many different pots that you have your hands in. That NGO trading has definitely paid off. I can see it. You are like, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And you're allowing the public to interact in all those different spaces as well.
Yes.
Honestly, hands off to you there. It just shows your commitment and dedication. And even speaking to you now, it's just like emitting. And I'm so excited to continue to learn more about CTPH here. When you've just mentioned, off the end of that, you'll work with the local communities and then wanting to source out traditional medicine and through plants. And then you had the interaction of them taking the plants and making their own seedlings in their own, for example, farms or back gardens. How does CTPH blend this traditional knowledge with modern healthcare practices for these communities and as well as wildlife?
Yeah, it's been quite an interesting journey, blending the modern traditional knowledge with the modern practices, because, for example, we found out that the Batwa, who were the hunter-gatherers who lived in the park, They know so much, and we don't want to lose that knowledge. They know that all the different species of types of honey. They know, you know, like the bees that are stingless and stinging, and they know how to do so much. And so as much as possible, we want to engage the traditional knowledge with what we're doing. One thing that I can say is that there's a very tricky situation. You know, women were losing babies because they're giving birth at home. So we started to engage the traditional birth attendants. And what we did is not by taking away their business, but by encouraging them to be part of our One Health model. And some of them are village health and conservation teams. We encourage them to encourage women to give birth in the local health center safely. And then they can still do the prenatal and antenatal care. You know, the antenatal and postnatal care, make sure that they're fine after they get back home and everything. And they really embrace that. Another thing was, of course, the traditional healers, you know, like if somebody has tuberculosis or HIV, they would go to the traditional healers first. And we got the traditional healers to admit that they can't treat TB or HIV. They said they were also getting it, but they now refer people to the health centers, and then they become their volunteer who watches them taking their medicine every day for 8 months until they get better. And so they still believe that it's the traditional healer who made them better, not necessarily only the, you know, not necessarily okay. the modern healer who provided the initial medication. They realize that it's a joint effort. And so in this way, because normally we find that the traditional healers have a better bedside manner. They really care about you. They ask, how's your family? Whereas when they go
they're more connected to the community, would you say?
Yes. When they go to the health centers, it's just they find an overworked nurse or midwife who doesn't really care about them, just when I give them medication. And so it's so important to keep integrating the traditional and modern. But one other area I wanted to mention was we all have clans in Uganda. And when your clan or totem prevents you from harming your clan or totem. So for example, for me, my clan is the lion clan, and all the people in my clan are not allowed to touch a lion. And so we use those totems also in our conservation education with the children and adults to be able to identify with their clans and realize it's sometimes your clan. My mother, for example, her clan is a very rare plant. My father is a lion, and you normally take your father's clan. So it helps.
I was just going to ask that.
Plants. I know. It helps to protect the plants and the animals, and it's very important. It was a traditional way that our forefathers, our ancestors used to, they were conservationists actually. Long before the conservation concept came in, when the missionaries came, they were conservationists in their own way. There was always a group of people who protected a certain animal, whether it's an elephant, buffalo, you know, wherever it is, they're always there.
It's a link to us. We're part of the animal kingdom. Like, we're there, we're present, like, we're aware of this. It's always been innate to us as humans that we have this factor. It's just expanded, and the way that has adapted and changed over time is now we put it under the sphere of conservation. But we've all always had that within us, I think.
Yes, we have. We always have. And it's good to tap into that in order to continue conservation efforts and not kind of ignore it. Because that's where people came from, and they can always relate to that.
Amazing. On that note, we're going to take a quick break to hear from our station sponsors, and we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Our Altered World. I'm here with Gladys Kalema Zikosoka from Conservation Through Public Health. We just left off on talking about the innate human desire for conservation in our way that we interact with the world and the planet, and how it's grown and adapted over time. With that being said, CTPH has worked through so many distinct factors in both public health and wildlife conservation. Where do you hope to expand your model next?
Well, thank you so much. We have been lucky to be able to test this model. CTPH is now 22 years old, believe it or not. And we're glad that we've had many donors who've supported us, like Wildlife Conservation Network, from very early days. I would say that we've tested the model at Bwindi, and Bwindi will always be the testing site for different things, whether they work or not. But we do want to scale up the model in other parts of Uganda, and especially other gorilla habitats. Uganda only has actually Bwindi Impenetrable National Park and Mugahinga National Park. In Mugahinga, we're mainly just focusing on the gorilla health monitoring part of our program. We take care of all the gorillas in Uganda, but we haven't really started the community programs, and we want to do many more of that. We also want to expand to neighboring the Democratic Republic of Congo, where we have two small programs which are on and off because of the insecurity, but we want to really expand them, not only with the mountain gorillas, but the eastern lowland gorillas, whose numbers are going down, actually, because of hunting. They don't have tourism, they don't have health benefits for the community. There's many things that they don't have, and we want to get certain aspects of our model to go to these places. We also want to possibly go to Rwanda and other countries in Africa that have gorillas. Nigerians have expressed an interest. They want us to take our model there. We don't have to be there in person. We don't have to set up shop, but we want to work with local partners so they can, and help them to adapt our model, because it's very expensive holding or having offices all over. But it is, we'd love the impact of the One Health model to spread. We know it's also very helpful in savanna habitats. And we've done elements of it in Queen Elizabeth National Park. And, you know, where I first went as a secondary school student. And also we've had elements of it in Budongo, where the chimpanzees are, Budongo Forest. And we are wanting, we know that there are 10 countries in Africa that have gorillas and 21 that have great apes, which is chimpanzees as well. So we know that this model can work really well where with great apes. And we're hoping to work with different partners across the continent to scale it up.
What do you need to achieve this? How do you best see this happening? Is it government support? Is it funding? What is it that you need to make this happen?
I'd say it's all of the above. We definitely need government support because it is a disruptive model. Normally people integrate, only have do conservation work or traditional health work, but we're bringing the two together.
So amazingly, we do need, I might add.
Thank you. So we do need the government to buy into it. They really need to buy into it because it's going to disrupt their models. So, for example, if they have existing community health workers, we have to tell them we have to train them to do conservation work so they become community conservation health workers. And so the government needs to buy into that. There's a lot of advocacy needed to the government and the donors, who a lot of donors also fund single sector. They only fund traditional conservation or traditional public health or traditional development. And now we're telling them, actually, if you do it holistically, and you
want to show them the intersectionality, saying these things don't happen in vacuums. They're happening intersectionally. They're happening together. They're affecting each other.
Yes, we'd like to show them that they all have to happen together in order for it to work. And a few donors have come on board, like MacArthur Foundation was one of our first donors to understand that it all connects, and Wildlife Conservation Network and others. But yes, there's a lot of government, donor education, and of course, finding the right partners. You know, you have to find the right partners as well, because otherwise it won't happen. And they have to be open. Actually, their biggest advocacy is to the actual partners, whether it's the NGOs, you know, the charities, or the local hospitals, or the government agencies. You still have to convince people who you're going to work with. I find that the communities are the easiest to convince, because they can't decide, today my animals are going to get sick, my goats will get sick, tomorrow it's going to be, my child's going to get sick the next day.
They're at the front lines. They're at the front lines of all of the exposure, of all the changes, of all the impacts. So there, I can definitely see why they'd be like, yeah, like, I'm ready, please.
Yes, they like to have everything coming at once. We also encourage them to plant trees in their gardens so they don't have to enter the forest to collect firewood. And maybe shade trees as well, that they can eat food. So there's a lot going on there, but the communities are always the easiest to convince. It's just working with the partners, the government and the donors to make it happen.
When it comes to the community, so we've mentioned so far the impacts that they've had in terms of hunting and their awareness of gorilla tourism. Now, I know that gorilla tourism is a major economic driver in Uganda. How is CTPH ensuring that this is benefiting both the wildlife and the local communities, and also how that relates to preventing disease transmission?
Yes, ecotourism is very important. It's actually what's helped the mountain gorilla numbers to grow. We're very excited that the numbers have steadily grown for mountain gorillas only subspecies, unlike the eastern lowland, western lowland, across the river, where there isn't really much tourism going on. But I would say that gorilla tourism is a necessary evil. I do have a chapter in my book, Is Tourism a Necessary Evil? Because basically, I think we need it to support conservation efforts, but it has to be done carefully. Otherwise, it's going to kill the golden goose. And the biggest threat to the great apes is, because we're all great apes, humans, gorillas, chimpanzees, orangutans, we're all great apes and we can all make each other sick very easily because we share, you know, 98% genetic material, gorillas 98.4, chimpanzees 98.8. And so we have to make sure that when people visit the gorillas, they're healthy. They shouldn't be below 15 years old because when you're under 15 years old, you carry a lot of childhood diseases. They should be ready to be responsible tourists, like not wanting to get really close, not trying to touch them because they're so accommodating. But it's also harmful if they try and get too close. But then also we try and tell them, you know, they have to wear masks. During the COVID pandemic, we led the effort to advocate to the government that everyone must wear masks when they visit the mountain gorillas. The government readily accepted it. It was easy for them to accept it because all over the world, people are wearing masks in China and wherever. As the pandemic eventually made it to Uganda, mask wearing became the new norm. But at the same time, keeping a distance, a respectable distance, which helps you to observe them and their normal behaviors, but also at the same time helps to protect them from our diseases. So that's kind of, we've really been pushing this, responsible tourism to the great apes. Another thing that we've added, we wrote a policy brief to promote responsible tourism to great apes during the pandemic. And we wrote it together with International Gorilla Conservation Program that started, helped to start gorilla tourism in Uganda, but also with under the Africa CSO Biodiversity Alliance. And we were looking at ways of reducing the impact of COVID because it was a very stressful time for everyone. And so they really liked that idea. And we wrote this policy brief geared towards the governments, the donors, and the tour operators and their tourists, because the tour operators are the ones who market the experience and tell tourists, oh, you can get really close, you can take a selfie, you know, and they market the wrong, sometimes the wrong experience that we want people to have. So we need to target them and their tourists to make sure that they do the right thing. We also developed a website with the University of Exeter, led by Dr. Kim Hawkins at University of Exeter too, and funded by the Darwin Initiative. And that website basically tells people what they can do before they come. So that's one side of it. But in this policy brief, we also talked about what is it, what does a responsible tourist do? They don't only visit the gorillas and go home. They should also support the local communities because they are, it's all part of the conservation. Because if you buy a craft from a local community member or you hire them to take you up to the gorillas, to carry your luggage to the gorillas, you're already supporting the local economy. It's a real job. Some tourists are like, no, I don't need a porter. Maybe they feel uncomfortable, but actually it's a highly respectable job and they help stop you from falling down the hill or they can pull you up when it gets really tiring and it's steep. And it really makes a big difference because if people have earning a living in other ways, they're much less likely to poach. So that's kind of the responsible tourism model that we're promoting.
Wow, that was so well said. You compounded all the rest of my three questions. I was thinking, oh, wow, I want to ask this. And then you led into it perfectly. And I was like, oh, I love that. She's really in her vibe here, really in her element. And you're so passionate about it. When it comes to responsible tourism, I know you just mentioned a website there briefly, but how can people ensure that they are actively participating in responsible ecotourism? For example, when they're looking to book out group tours or anything related to travel in that sense. Is there, aside from that website, a way that they can know that they're doing that correctly?
Yes, that's a great question. I guess the website is called protectgreatapesfromdisease.com. One way that they can know that they're doing the right thing, when they make the booking, they should read all the guidelines. They find even with the Wildlife Authority, they have the guidelines. The tour operators who they're working with, they should ask them, how can I ensure that I don't harm the wildlife when I'm going? And if it's a good tour operator, they'll tell them, oh yes, you have to follow these rules and everything. Then they book with that particular tour operator. So that's one way that people can really ensure that they do the right thing.
Yeah,
but they should come
responsible themselves. They should, in their responsible tourism.
Yes, it should start with themselves. I have had people asking me that I don't really want to come and visit because I don't want to harm the animals. And I'm like, if you do it the right way, you're actually benefiting the animals. They're not coming
absolutely.
At all. Yes. So it also depends on somebody's comfort level and how they really are feeling about this issue. There's a lot of education that can happen before people can even arrive. And I think maybe
you're educating them right now. They're learning right now.
But they should come with a protective face mask. It helps a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so many other things.
They'll know now. They'll say, okay, all right, I want to go and do some gorilla tourism. I want to make sure that I'm going with a responsible tour operator. I know that, okay, now I know that I can make an impact in terms of the health that I go there with can impact these local gorilla communities. And that can, as a knock-on effect, also affect the local communities. I should know now to wear a mask. So I think these are all important steps towards education. When it comes to the future for mountain gorillas, what is giving you hope right now?
I'd say that what is giving me hope for the future of mountain gorillas is the fact that so many people are aware of how important they are. You know, like 30 years ago or like 1994 when I first went out, I grew up in Kampala, the capital city of Uganda. I basically made new friends when I went out to Bwindi, which is deep in the rural areas bordering DRC. And my friends in Kampala used to think I was crazy. Why are you going to the bush all the time? And a lot of people thought we were a bit crazy. Why are you even caring about these wild animals that much? But now people realize how important they are. The mountain gorillas have actually brought tourism back to Uganda. After it disappeared during the Idi Amin days, the mountain gorillas have actually brought tourists back to Uganda. They provide 60% of the revenue for the whole nature tourism in Uganda, which helps to not only support rangers who are carrying out anti-poaching, but supports the community as well. So they're the most important national park is Bwindi Impenetrable National Park. So already the economic incentive is really, really great because of the mountain gorillas. And that gives me hope because people don't want to harm them. They see the gorillas as their future. And we'd like the same to be everywhere. But also we want to tell people they're so close to us. We have an ethical obligation to look after this species, you know. And so the more that we have young people involved in what we're doing, the youth and everybody, that gives me hope. I'm a founder member of the African Primate Society. I'm currently the vice president. And we're building African leadership in primate research and conservation. And the more that you have people leading these conservation efforts and research efforts, they're the ones who are going to change their society, because some of them may even end up being members of parliament. But if you have enough of them in parliament saying, we need to protect the great apes, then the right decisions will be made in parliament. And so, yeah, that gives me a lot of hope.
One
thing I can say is I'm also excited that the number of mountain gorillas is growing. And in April, we're going to do another census after 2018, drop them from critically endangered to endangered in 2018 by the IUCN. But the only issue we have now is that there's not enough space for the gorillas to grow. They've run out of space.
Okay.
And so now we need to raise money to convince people to sell their land for the gorillas. And actually, what gives me hope is 300 landowners have said they want to sell their land. And so now we need to find donors to be able to buy the land so that we expand the protected habitat for the mountain gorillas.
I think it really speaks for itself there with those 300 landowners, because it relates to the work that you've done in the communities to get them to understand the beneficiary effect that it will have, not only on them, but their land and as well as the local wildlife. We've spoken here just about your hopes for the future and what really makes you strong in your determination to see the success of the future of gorilla conservation. I would love for you to talk about what has been your proudest achievement, whether it's in the past 5 years or you guys have been running for 22 years, you said. Is there a specific story that really has resonated with you, whether it's a community success story or a particular gorilla success story?
I'd say there's a couple of things. I'll start off with a story that doesn't have to do with numbers. When an elderly silverback was very ill, he was too slow to keep up with the group, he decided to settle in community land because he felt safe there. And we convinced the community to protect him, and they did. Because they said when their elderly get sick, they protect them. And when Ruhendeza finally died, they all came to pay their last respects, which has showed how much the community has learned to coexist with the gorillas and really care. But one thing I can also say is that our model has shown that the model households have almost more than doubled from 23% to 59% of the past 2 years, the households that have all the ideal indicators, which means that their health and well-being is improving with positive impacts on the gorillas and their habitat.
Amazing. What is one takeaway you want listeners to remember about the interconnection between human, wildlife and ecosystem?
I'd say that one takeaway I'd like people to remember is that you can't address human health alone or animal health or ecosystem health, because each one affects the other. You know, you have to address them all together, because if people are not doing well, the animals will not do well, as we've shown in the case of the gorillas. If the animals are not doing well, the people won't do well. And so it's very important to work together in an interdisciplinary way. Just one health is one of those ways, so that people and animals and the ecosystem needs can be addressed holistically. And I think that's one big takeaway, that you can't protect the wildlife without improving the health and well-being of the local communities, which I talk about a lot in my book, Walking with Gorillas. And I'm so excited that Dr. Jane Goodall wrote the foreword.
Where can people access your book?
They can access it all around the world on Amazon, but also in bookstores like Waterstones. We did a book launch there, and Barnes & Noble and different places around the world. So it's available in many places.
Amazing. And where can people learn more about CTPH? And I'd love for you to leave your final message of hope for wildlife conservation in Uganda and maybe even globally.
I'd say that people can learn more about our work by visiting our website, ctph.org. They can also learn about our work by, we also have a website for the coffee, gorillaconservationcoffee.org. You can come and visit us in Uganda and learn about what we do and just be a responsible tourist. But I would say that my hope for the future is that we can all make a difference in conservation. It doesn't matter what profession you're in, what you're doing, we can all make a difference, and we all need to make a difference in conservation because we are so dependent on having a healthy planet. If we have a healthy planet, all of us are going to do well. The animals will do well. The ecosystems will do well. The environment will do well. So my hope is that everyone can get engaged, whether you're a primary school child or a politician, the full range. We all can do our part for conservation and climate change.
Thank you, Gladys, so much. That was very beautifully said. Well, thank you so much for listening to Our Altered World today. If you enjoyed the show, I'd love for you to visit our website, ouralteredworld.com, where you can join our community and find more information on upcoming shows. You can also find some of my work on social media at Flunking Monkey, FlunkingMonkey. And until next time, I hope you all have a great day.
Thank you very much.